I do think there's a right way to pronounce Sanskrit because it is a language of sound and because it is about where your tongue is placed in your mouth to create vibrations, to create energetic shifts within you. And that's why there's an importance there. So that you're respecting the culture, sure, that's one thing. But the second thing, so that you're getting the most out of actually pronouncing it correctly and the vibrations and the energy.
Today, we're joined by Angie Tiwari. With over 10 years of experience in the corporate world, Angie educates businesses on well-being and high performance, sharing holistic leadership techniques and accessible rituals backed by science. She's dedicated to increasing emotional intelligence, reducing burnout and imposter syndrome, and elevating company culture. Angie is a qualified yoga, meditation, and breathwork coach, as well as an Ayurveda lifestyle and nutrition consultant. Her coaching extends to high performers and athletes, and Angie is the founder of Tiwari Yoga and Unearthed, her well-being community, membership platform, and retreats. She aims to bring diversity, inclusion, and accessibility to the forefront. Angie works with individuals through private coaching, hosting retreats, which were recently commended by Condé Nast and The Times as being best for beginners in the UK and Ireland, and collaborates with businesses for corporate coaching sessions and panel discussions. She's a highly recognized media spokesperson covering topics on well-being, ancient rituals and modern life, and celebrating South Asian culture. Angie, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really glad we're having this conversation. I first came across your platform on Instagram and I saw some really cool content, and I think it was like a video where you were talking about pronouncing I need to be careful here. Mantra. I saw that video and I was really actually interested. I was like, wow, this person seems super fascinating that they're talking about something like this, that ordinarily it's just kind of like, yeah, it's the pronunciation secondary, you know, like, especially in my world where I'm trying to share mantra with the world and I'm trying to make that my kind of focus. And I do westernize some of these words. I do kind of make them a little, let's call them, is colonial the right way of saying it? I do colonize the practices, and I know that that's something that you're quite passionate about. So I wanted to go straight in at the deep end. Decolonizing yoga, is it important and why?
Yeah, it's a big topic. It's a big question. And it's the topic of colonialism, white supremacy, white privilege, all of these things, racism, are very heavy topics. And they can make people feel defensive and like they don't want to learn. And I'm really conscious that that word decolonizing does that. But I also don't think that because they are deep topics, we shouldn't tackle them. And I really believe there's a way in tackling these topics that allows more people to feel included and part of the conversation. So with pronouncing certain words, certain Sanskrit words, certain ancient words, certain mantras, I think it is really important because I don't think we have to water down the practice in order to make it accessible to a more dominant group who have really benefited from our culture, which many people have, and absolutely everybody is allowed to. I say quite a lot, yoga is not for one group of people. I really believe it is for everybody. And that's why taking it into the corporate space is so important, because it's not just about relaxation. It is about focus. It is about improving the culture, improving your relationships. There are studies that show it increases job satisfaction, how you speak with your colleagues, all of that kind of stuff. It comes back to self-awareness. But I think yoga is for everybody, but how do we make everybody feel included? And there are a lot of people from South Asian community who get really frustrated, myself included, hearing these words being pronounced so incorrectly. It feels like there's no care in even trying to pronounce these words correctly. And like you said earlier, it's kind of always been secondary. So it's fine. Let's all pronounce the word chakra, the energy centers. Let's all call it chakra. Everyone call it chakra. And these people who are at the top or well-known in the industry are teaching all these future yoga teachers or yoga students. So we're all going around pronouncing quite an important part within us, within yogic philosophy, within Vedic scriptures, incorrectly. It doesn't feel right. It feels like we don't need to blame anyone or shame anyone when we talk about decolonization. We shouldn't say, okay, the British colonized India, therefore the British are colonizers currently. You can't blame anyone. Our ancestors did that. So whether you were colonized or whether you're the colonizers, doesn't matter now. Today, it's like, how do we all respect a practice that we get so much out of? And I think some, you and I know, there are some little subtleties that are difficult to say. Absolutely. And I think probably because we were raised with mantra, it's a little bit easier. We know where to place the tongue in the mouth. But that is such an important part of the language of Sanskrit. It's how you move your mouth to make certain words, to create certain vibrations. Mm. I think one thing with decolonizing is that there's two ways you can look at it and there's two paths you go down. The first is you feel guilt for doing it wrong. You feel like you're being blamed. You feel like you're part of the problem and you think, I shouldn't even teach anymore. I give up. And then there's the other path, which is the path I'm trying to encourage people and empower people to go down, which is I made a mistake, like all of us do, and all of us will continue to do. How do I write that mistake? How do I make it correct for the next time I say it? How do I learn how to say this word correctly? Mm-hmm. And that's what I try and do through my Instagram is share little snippets of here's how you pronounce it correctly. And people, because they want to learn. And when they chant a mantra, they want to know what's the meaning rather than just chanting it blindly without any understanding. It kind of loses the meaning 100%. And it loses the, it kind of makes the culture feel like, oh, that's not really important. Like we don't have to say these words correctly, like it's fine. So that is why decolonization is important. But I caveat it with how do we bring that conversation to light? And how do we do it in a way that makes people who are not from the culture and from the culture feel included and feel part of the conversation. And like they're safe to be able to make mistakes. Like it's a safe space. You can make a mistake. We all do. But how do we move forward from those mistakes? Do we give up or do we pave a path forward to teach in an accurate way?
Amazing. I think one thing that really comes out while you're speaking was that there is, I think that sometimes when you're trying to educate, then it can come across as, you're putting people down by them not being, you know, not knowing or them not having the proper pronunciation. We could easily just say, you don't know what you're doing, therefore don't do it. But I just love the way that you're approaching this, that it's a case of let's try and share in a way that it's not about that means you can't do it, but rather give it a go like this instead. And I think that's so important. And I like how you said that people who are at the top and not that I'm anywhere near the top of the mantra game or sharing. Let's try and be really proper today. Kirtan, you know, we're trying to share that. I think that it's important that I do try, but I think I have also in some sense kind of given up along the way a little bit because it just becomes such a, in one sense, pain to continuously. So that's why I wanted to ask, what gives you the strength to be able to, is there maybe a younger version of you that had an experience that really still kind of like holds you that this should be prevalent? Or what kind of drives you to continue that mission of trying to, share authentically, I guess, the practices that are there?
I think there's two things. So the first thing is I've been part of the problem. I'm not afraid to say that because we all make mistakes. So I was going to classes and blindly chanting some mantra that I didn't know. I don't know all the mantras in the universe, even though it's from my culture. I was going to yoga classes and saying it blindly. Mm. Was the teacher explaining it? No, but it's fine. I was just doing it. And that is okay because we all make mistakes. But then the second thing I wanted to say is I've learned about the history and the context, which is really important because that's what forms these systems that are in place. And when things are inbuilt in the system, it benefits one predominant group of society. Cultural appropriation is the dominant group taking a practice from the culture, taking the parts of the culture that they want and removing the rest, eliminating the rest. I love what you're doing with Kirtan. I'm obsessed with mantra from my childhood, and I'm sure we'll get into that.
You need to come to one of my events.
Yes, I really do.
Let's go and chant together.
I do, let's do it. But I didn't know the darker history of how yoga was made illegal in India when British ruled. And
is that for real?
Yeah, so that happened. And let's be real, India's been independent for 76 years this year. My dad's 75 this year. Wow. That is not that long ago. And so when you think about these beautiful practices and these rituals, that are for everyone. Let's make that really clear, and everyone can benefit from them. But when you see the way that it's represented today, it's only predominantly the physical posture, which also is incredible and I love, and I love working towards a certain pose. But that is the definition of cultural appropriation. Let's not argue with the term. It's from a different culture. It's represented by people predominantly not from that culture in the West, which is a problem. And only a small little element is being shown. That's why it's great what you're doing, because you're bringing other elements from the practice. But knowing that and realizing that and then doing the work to learn about the history, which has only really been happening over the last couple of years, has been a really painful experience for me and definitely caused some anger within me. But then I've tried to turn that anger into, well, what change can I be? Because as a yoga teacher, which is such a saturated industry, there are so many of us, what's important for me to bring to the table, and why do I want to bring the pronunciation of certain words? And now that I've been doing that for a while, I'm seeing so many people, I'm realizing, and the anger has subsided, people are actually causing harm unintentionally. Right. Like, I think majority of people, they don't know how to pronounce. And if there's no one saying this is how you pronounce that, and if everyone is fine saying chakra, 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 I'll say chakra too, because I think that's how it's said. So then it's also, I guess what's also driven me is realizing the impact you're having. And if 5 people go away learning how to pronounce a word correctly, and their I have a lot of yoga teachers come to retreats and events that I run. If they go and then teach their 5 people, and that it's then it spreads, and people and ultimately it seems like a really, really small minor thing. It's a subtle thing, how you pronounce a word. But when you zoom out, you look at, well, actually it's you pronouncing that word correctly is a way to show that you're respecting the culture from where yoga originated. And that is what's really important when you look at the context and you look at the way that the yoga industry is today and how there aren't that many South Asian faces there. I mean, there are plenty, but I mean kind of in the mainstream yoga industry. So I guess that's what drives me. There's a few different reasons. It's making the mistake. It's understanding what happened way back when and really appreciating my culture more, which I've done as I've got older. And then the third thing is seeing the change that you're making and being inspired to make more and more change. Because there are so many words that are being pronounced incorrectly, and that's okay. But if I can help people know how to pronounce it correctly, then that's me doing my little bit.
Yeah, I love that. And what kind of pinpointed me to, or what prompted me to having this conversation with you, was I went to New York and did an episode with Eddie Stern. And he said that he feels that the yoga tradition and Hinduism are linked. Mm. And he made it really clear. He said that we've kind of cut out Hindu from yoga.
Yeah.
And actually, it's the other way. There is no yoga without Hindu. And so the word Hindu, I know the origins, and it's not actually, there's no such thing as the word Hindu. It's, for those that didn't know this, that the word Hindu comes from when the British came to India and they found a colony living on the river Sindhu. And because they didn't know what the religion was called, they just called them, oh, these are the Hindus. They couldn't even say the Sindhus. These are the Hindus. And actually, Sanatan Dharma. Sanatan Dharma is the actual name of the tradition. And that translates not as any sort of like race or anything. It translates literally as eternal path or eternal duty. And this whole thing kind of really came to a forefront when I spoke with Eddie. And he said that he feels that the yoga tradition and the guru tradition are linked. Mm-hmm. The yoga tradition and Hinduism are linked. And it's interesting how through the name of accessibility or the name of relevancy, we've kind of cut out those things which we feel maybe don't fit the market branding, don't maybe look in such a way that it's going to attract a Western face immediately.
Mm.
So,
and all those things you're describing, that is the definition of cultural appropriation.
Straight up.
But we need to be careful with how we respond to that word. And I think there are definitely some people who are bringing deep topics to light in a way that makes you want to be defensive because you feel like you're being attacked. And I think partially it's that. And then I think partially it's you need to be self-aware and you need to apply the yoga to how you are coping with that situation when it comes up so that you feel more open to want to make a change, because that is the definition of the appropriation. So then how can you appreciate it? But I think to your point, people are you know, religion, people are scared to do practices that are for religion that's not necessarily their religion. They might not be religious at all. Yoga is linked to Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism, so multiple religions, but it's also deeper than that, a spiritual practice. So kind of on a separate note, it is also spirituality. So you don't need to necessarily identify as Hindu and Buddhist and Sikh and Jain to practice it. I think that's where there's the confusion. I don't want to do that because it's a religious practice. How do I market it? And that's the way that it's been marketed now to students as not religious, because my students don't want to learn about religion. They don't want to know this. And that is the appropriation. It's let's take the warrior one, warrior two, let's take the splits pose and let's remove all of the other stuff. And the problem is that the British made yoga illegal predominantly because yogis were non-conforming. They didn't want to convert to Christianity, right? And the practices were seen as too, and I'm doing very clear inverted commas here, too woo-woo and too spiritual. And so then we're fast forward to today. When you understand the context, you understand, oh, this is quite problematic, actually, the way that the world is represented and the way that we're just so, it's so normalized to see yoga teachers look a particular way and not go deeper. Why is there no one from the culture from where yoga originated here? Like that's so bizarre. But it's not bizarre, because if you close your eyes right now and you visualize a yoga teacher, be honest, what are you seeing?
Lululemon.
Lululemon.
I'm joking. What do I see? I'm seeing...
Describe the person that you see when I say the word yoga teacher.
I see a man. I see Indian skin. I see him wearing, what do you call it? I don't even know what it's called. Like, it's like, this is just first impression, okay?
Like a dhoti. I think it's like a loincloth, yeah.
Loincloth, but it's rolled up. So it's kind of like more lungi style than it is the dhoti style. So yeah,
that's okay, that's beautiful. I wish we all saw that, because I don't see that.
That's because that was like my first, maybe one of the early impressions of when I saw someone do yoga.
Yeah. And look, we all have different views of what that means. I think when we think Western yoga industry, generally see someone able-bodied, because you've got to be able to move, which is obviously not true, because yoga is not just about movement. It's one element of it. Someone who's pretty slim, which is also excluding many people who are in bigger bodies who don't feel like they can be part of the practice. Generally, it's someone who's white, and generally, it's someone who's really, really flexible. And people who practice yoga look, from your imagination, different, right? Everybody looks different, but how do we create a roster of people in the mainstream yoga industry who look different from one another rather than just one aesthetic? Because when there's just one aesthetic, we all feel like we need to fit into that one aesthetic in order to be able to do the practice. And that excludes so many people. So there's the cultural appropriation level, there's a decolonizing level of it and that kind of lens. But then there's also the lens of, if I want to just take part in the practice, I want to be able to see people who look like me, like not just me, but like all these different people in society, because it is a practice for everyone.
I love that. I think it's so important that that is vocalized more and more. I mean, it is changing.
Like, yeah,
someone
it is
like
changing.
Me, someone like me, I don't think I would be. I mean, maybe I'm just being totally blind and not really being truthful, but I feel that 5 or 10 years ago, people wouldn't turn up to events that I was doing. And it was because I didn't fit the conformed view of someone that would be chanting. Like, a lot of the people who are famous in the world of chanting and mantra and kirtan, they're all Western. They're all Jewish by heritage. And that's why when I first started, actually one of the people that I spoke to about it said, you're great at what you do, but you don't fit the look. And I was like, what do you mean? Like,
really?
Yeah, I was like, what do you mean I don't fit the look? And they said, well, you're not white-bodied, you're not a woman. And I mean, all these different things, they're quite straight with me that they said, this is going to be a challenge for you. And they weren't saying it out of a place of hatred. They were just being dead honest.
Yeah.
And
this is what the industry is like at the moment.
This is what the industry is like at the moment. Deva Pramal, Krishna Das, Jayutal, they're all my icons. I love them to bits, because what they're doing is powerful. And I think that the practices that they're sharing are powerful. But there's no one that's represented in the South Asian color skin body. And in my opinion, that, you know, elite. And so I don't think 5 or 10 years ago I would be where I am now.
Yeah.
But I am thinking and seeing the change. And maybe it's people like you that are making that possible. So my hands folded. Thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you for doing what you're doing. And everything that you felt and that you have experienced is exactly where I'm at. There's nothing wrong with these icons bringing our beautiful culture to the modern world. Nothing wrong with it. And that's all great stuff, right? But where is the representation of the people from where the culture originated? And that's one of the reasons why my online membership platform and the retreats is called Unearthed, because it's unearthing these ancient rituals that you don't often see in a yoga class or you don't often see in a meditation practice. And it's unearthing these things that ultimately lie deep within you. And it's unearthing the way that, like, how do we connect more with the earth? Because we, as in society, have become so disconnected. We've become so unearthed. So how do we kind of, through these rituals, get back to ourselves more? Mm.
Unearthed even brings about, like, unlearning, like, deconstructing, you know, things that have been traditionally rooted as they are. Like, okay, now when you think of the yoga traditions and the most famous context, they're all Western bodied, etc. Like you were saying, flexible, etc., able-bodied. But then how do we unlearn those things? How do we unearth those things? What are the methods for? I know that one of them has to be just speaking and being more present in teaching those things. Mm. But do you have any other ways that people can unlearn or unearth these kind of practices?
I think it's a really challenging thing to unlearn, because you're unpicking thought patterns that have been, they're literal neural pathways in your brain.
Yeah, they're almost some scars.
Absolutely. And we're all made up of
deep impressions.
We are all made up of those deep impressions. We're all made up of the thought patterns that we're conditioned to believe. And so to unlearn is to unpick. And it's to unpick what we know. And when we unpick what we know, we're met with this barrier of, well, hang on, the brain's like, what are you doing? This is, what? Wait, stop. No. Because in order to create a new thought pattern, your brain literally has to create a new neural pathway. And that takes time to do. So the instant reaction can be defensiveness. No. You know, the stubbornness that we all have within us, that's just human fact. So you have to do the inner work to unpick, to unlearn. And you also have to be confronted with the fact that you have got it wrong and you have made mistakes. And that's at the point that you take the two paths. Do you give up because you've made the mistakes and you feel guilty and you feel like blamed and I shouldn't teach yoga because I'm white and I've been appropriating, oh my God, I'm so bad. Or do you think it's okay to make mistakes in this journey? What can I do to not in the future? And that's on you as an individual. And there's many people that I teach who I'm sure will stay in that first path and they will be riddled with blame and guilt and they won't want to share mantra anymore because they can't pronounce it correctly or they're too scared to. But I hope there's more people who go down the pathway of, okay, let me learn. You know, pronouncing Shanti, it's not too difficult, but it's quite easy to recognize that it's not Om Shanti, 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 and it's Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. It's a slight little change that, if you can say I was about to say Beethoven in a Hindi accent then. If you're about to say Beethoven, if you can say Beethoven and you can look at how Beethoven is spelled. It's spelled Beethoven.
Yeah.
If you can say I'm in my Indian voice now. If you can say Beethoven, or if you can say, and look, it's even, I have a British voice and I've got to switch into my, to make the sounds in the mouth. Yeah. It's a conscious effort for me as well.
It's a conscious effort.
But I think there's subtle changes that do have a bigger implication with this stuff. So I think unlearning is definitely not an easy thing to do. And you have to step up to the plate and you've got to do it. If you really are dedicated to the practice, especially if you decided to teach, I believe you have a responsibility to the culture. I believe you have a responsibility to the ancient indigenous art of yoga and to give respect to it, to not be afraid of doing that work.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why, like, I've decided to have, well, right now I've got one India retreat that happens.
Amazing.
And next year we're going to do two, because people were saying, why don't you do Bali? And I was like, well, with the practice of kirtan and mantra, I feel it's rooted in India and I want to take people back to that.
Yeah.
And I love Bali. I think it's a beautiful place. I love doing things in Europe. And obviously Europe is more affordable to do stuff here, like the registration fee. Even though my retreats, everyone knows, like, I try to keep them as cheap as possible because my purpose isn't to, I don't want to, monetarily earn super amounts for my retreats. But the point is that, European retreats, but I want to take people to the place where these practices originate.
Yeah.
And I think there's a beauty in that, because even I don't know everything, you know, I'm still trying.
Absolutely. That is absolutely it as well. So many people ask me, like, oh, where should I do my teacher training? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There are so many yoga teacher schools out there. You've got to do your own research. I don't have one school. I'm going to always say this school, right. Not even the school I went to. Right. You need to do your research. What's important to you? What do you want to learn? Because as yoga teachers, we should be constantly learning, and everyone, actually, forget what your industry is or what your role is, constantly learning, constantly growing, constantly being that seeker, And I think when you lose that willingness to seek and eagerness to learn, then what is life about? Like, it's such a vast topic, and there's so many depths and layers you can go to through the practice of meditation and through your breath, that there's constantly more to explore, because we're always evolving as humans. Certainly. So there's also being open, I think, to share.
Yeah.
Like, we don't always know everything, and that's okay.
In the Bhagavad Gita, it says, in I think it's the second chapter or the fourth chapter, Kaylee, I don't know if you can correct me, mate, but it talks about how in order to learn from Guru, you need to have two qualities. One is you need to be humble, which means I don't know at all. And the other is you need to be enthusiastic. You need to have a desire to actually want to learn.
Yeah.
Without those two qualities, like, you could be really eager, but then, you know, full of pride,
yeah,
and a lack of humility. Whereas if you have these two qualities, humility and enthusiasm to learn, then it's very easy to learn, very easy to pick up things. And I think that those two prerequisites in themselves can take a whole lifetime to develop. Like, to learn how can I become more enthusiastic? That's like a whole search in itself, to spend time with those who are enthusiastic, to whatnot.
Yeah.
And humility is the same. Spend time with those who are learning. You know?
And it's the quality of the teacher as well as the quality of the student, because I think it's like the first, like the half, at least half the chapter is in the Bhagavad Gita, it's Arjuna asking questions. I'm in this like mental conflict. What do I do?
Chapter 4 where Krishna responds, and chapter like 18, like towards the end. But all the time you're just like, oh, what do I do?
It's a mental turmoil and conflict that everybody can resonate with having. And it's about listening to that. But also, and it says in the sutras, to be a good student is to constantly seek and constantly ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask these questions. You should always be asking and questioning your teachers, it doesn't have to be in a particular way, but questioning because you're genuinely interested in wanting to learn and grow. And actually through that, the teacher learns, the leader learns, because they might not know the answers to everything. Mm. And then you've invoked something within them, and there's another spark for them to go on and learn. So then there's constant learning, but I think a lot comes off the back of unlearning, especially the society we're in today. So unpacking, unlearning, and only then can the education begin.
Beautiful.
And then connection comes from there.
My spiritual teacher, my guru, he's actually German-bodied.
Okay.
So he's not born from India. But he once told me, he said his number one desire in this lifetime is to become a good student.
Mm.
Like, he said, that's my first service. My first service is to become a good disciple of my spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
And that was like very eye-opening for me, because it meant that no matter what level of you could be doing hundreds of people in a van, you could be having, you know, retreats all over the world, teaching in big arenas, but my number one service is just always be a student, to try and see, like, what is it that it's not that why is it as it is, it's what is this trying to teach me?
Yeah,
you know, what is this world trying to teach
there's
me?
There's a lesson in everything.
Straight up.
and the practice, what it's given me, is in being able to look at every situation that happens, and rather thinking, why has this happened to me? What did I do? So, you know, but actually looking at, what is this teaching me? Where is the lesson?
Yeah.
What could I have done better? Sure. What can I learn from this to apply in the future?
Yeah, I mean, selfishly, perception. That's the reason why I do these podcasts.
Yeah.
Because I'm forced to listen to other people's perspectives, people that even that I've never met before. Like, this is the first time we're meeting in person.
Mm.
And it's forcing me to actually learn. You know, and I think that that's sometimes necessary, to step outside of the comfort zone and just go, what is it that this person's going to share that I can just take away, that I can apply in some way, shape or form? So one thing that I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and watch something about the history of yoga, because I know nothing, like, literally about the history of yoga and like the colonization of yoga in India. I know nothing, because it's actually a blip. Like, you look at the thousands of years of culture that India's had.
Yeah.
And then how long was it that the British were in India?
So they were officially ruling for 89 years, but that technically they were in the country oppressing for about 200. But you're right.
Yeah.
The culture is so rich, and there's so much beautiful history there. So it's important to know. It's painful to realize and to know. And my ancestors were involved with the salt march and all of this kind of stuff. So you kind of realize, okay, how close it was to home. But then it's also important to learn about what's happened to your ancestors and your culture.
Because my focus has always been the ancient Vedic scriptures.
Like, yes.
Srimad Bhagavatam, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is 500 years ago, Bhagavad Gita, 5,000 years ago. That's my like range of knowledge. If you ask me about those things, I feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You ask me about the last like 100 years, including independence, I know jack, like literally don't know anything because it just hasn't been my range of study. Like I've never sat and studied that. Or never even, to be honest, like I watched a film on Mahatma Gandhi and that was like when I was, what, 10 or 11 years old. But since then, I haven't got a clue.
Mm.
I haven't got a clue. So that's, I'm taking that away. You mentioned the word meditation and I know you're a teacher of meditation. And we haven't done this in a while, but I'd like to do some meditation.
Let's do some meditation. We need to change how we're sitting though.
Okay,
we're allowed
let's
to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do it. Let's move.
Okay, so we're sitting up a little bit taller. I'm definitely uncrossing my legs.
Do I take my shoes off or leave them on?
You can leave your shoes on.
I'm taking them off.
Okay, take them off. Go for it. Mine are a bit zippy and difficult to get off, so okay, I won't be doing that. And then palms facing up to the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Close your eyes. So just in this moment, take some time to observe what's going on in your head. And where you can feel the breath in your body. The breath is our life force energy. It's known as the prana. And start to manipulate your breath. So take a deeper breath in consciously. And a deep breath out. Breathe in, fill your belly up. And release. So continue with that breath, conscious, being aware of it, in and out through your nose. And we'll change the position of our tongue in our mouth. So keeping the mouth closed, move the tongue so it's touching the roof of the mouth. Imagine as if you're trying to get the tongue to be in line with the very center. So you're drawing a line from the center of the spine all the way up through the center of your head, up to the top, to that Sahasrara chakra, the crown energy center. And in the middle of that line, you've got your tongue joining in and being part of it. Applying a little bit of pressure, so pushing the tip of the tongue up to the top. And it's easy to hold our breath, so continue to breathe in and out through your nose, but maintaining the contact of the tongue and the roof of your mouth. Slowly start to release your tongue, but keep the eyes closed and take a deep breath in through your nose. Little sigh out through the mouth. Let's do one more like that, breathing in. Breathe out like you're blowing out a candle. Observe if you noticed any changes in temperature in your physical body, any changes in colors of what you could maybe see even though your eyes were closed, and any shifts in your awareness and your differentiation between the external world and the internal. And then slowly open your eyes, but keep the gaze down. And then raise the eyes back up. How are you feeling?
That was nice. That was peaceful.
Any shifts or did you notice anything when your tongue hit the roof? Because some people have some really cool observations. I'd love to hear if you noticed anything. You can say no, by the way.
Felt like centered. I don't know if that's something that I'm meant to feel, but I just Like, you know, normally you'd think that when you're hosting a podcast, you'd be thinking about all the other things.
Mm.
But I was just able to just go, and just go, I'm here. This is where I am. And like you can notice, because you can normally feel that when you're nervous or something, or when you're feeling like really mindful of something, the eyes just flickering.
Yeah, like
that. I wasn't doing that. I mean, we can maybe rewind the camera and you guys can tell me in the comment section if my eyes were flickering. But as far as I could tell, I was kind of really here and present, which was kind of cool. And I mean, one of the observations I had was, you know, when you said notice the temperature of the body, I was like, I feel a little warmer, even though we've got the AC pumping in here.
Yeah.
I feel a bit warmer. And the color I saw was like a bluey color, purpley bluey color.
Okay.
I don't know if that means anything. I don't know any of this stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really cool to be able to see colors. A lot of people aren't able to do that. So it's always cool when you can, or if you are able to. But I want to touch on something you said, which was, I feel really centered.
Mm.
I don't know if that's how I was meant to feel.
Oh.
And I think that is so interesting, because you're in these practices, you do these practices, but I think ingrained in us as a thought pattern with so many of these rituals is, and because we're all perfectionists at heart, there's kind of this, you know, we want to get things right as humans. There's this, what is it meant to be like? Am I doing it right? Feeling. I'm not saying you are necessarily feeling like that, but it's interesting because I want people to know who are listening to this that there's no wrong or right way to feel. And some people may feel really centered and really energized and refreshed and calm, and other people may feel really, really anxious and, oh my goodness, now I'm suddenly still, all of my thoughts are coming to the kind of forefront. So there's not a right way to feel, and everybody experiences these things differently.
Right.
And it's being at peace and observing what happened for you today. Because if you did that tomorrow, it might be totally different. If you do it this evening, could be totally different. You just don't know. But I'm glad you feel centered. That's great.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, that was, okay, I need to say it. The other thing that was going through my mind was that, do I really agree with everything we spoke about with colonialism and chanting? And I was really wrestling with it. I was like, do I really agree? Like, okay, think about it, Radhika. You're saying all these things about, yes, we need to learn the history. And I agree with that. And I agree that we need to understand where the culture comes from and teach people about that culture. But the other thing during the meditation, it was interesting because there was a clarity and because I felt really like I wasn't thinking about what's next so much. Mm. But then I sat with it, I was like, there's some unease because, you know, something about it makes me think the essence is a little more important for me than the detail.
Mm.
Like, for example, I used to get really wound up when people used to say my name wrong.
How do you pronounce your name?
I say Radhika, even though I know it's Radhika with a A-D-H-I-K with an A on top as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that's called. But it used to wind me up because some people used to call me Radhiki. Yeah. Some people called me, what else have people, Rads. They just give up and they just go Rads. It used to wind me up. And then I just got to a point where the more it happened, the more I just kind of went, it's okay, like, and in one sense, maybe that's wrong. But I think with chanting, like, for example, maybe I'm being too loose here because maybe I'm talking about too many of the external things. But like, especially with chanting the name of God, like exactly how you said it, like with the meditation, what people are meant to feel and what's actually, it doesn't matter. Like it's a different experience for everyone.
Yeah.
And for example, chanting the name of God, like I chant the name of Krishna, I chant the name of Ram. And even like there's one mantra I chant, Radhe Govinda. Mm. And people say Radhe Govinda. Like they'll say it really Western. And it used to rub me up. But then I realized that the essence is there.
Mm.
I just want to get your input. Like I just want to hear what you're thinking. Like,
I think this is really important that you raised this, because sometimes people go to South Asian yoga teachers for the answer that every South Asian yoga teacher or every South Asian person thinks, we are not a monolith.
Right.
It's great that we're having a conversation where you have your opinion, I have my opinion, and they potentially might differ. I think that everyone's going to feel different things and everyone's going to bring, like get different things from the practice.
Fully, yeah.
And that's why I said, you know, in that meditation, there's no wrong or right way to feel. Absolutely. Mm. I do think there's a right way to pronounce Sanskrit because it is a language of sound and because it is about where your tongue is placed in your mouth to create vibrations, to create energetic shifts within you. And that's why there's an importance there. So that you're respecting the culture, sure, that's one thing. But the second thing, so that you're getting the most out of actually pronouncing it correctly and the vibrations and the energy. So that's why I do. But I think you sit with it, you know, like you sit with it. And it's, I have a friend, and at school we all call, she was the only Radhika that I knew then, but I had never heard that word before. I met her when I was 6 years old, and everyone, we all called her Radhika. And I only learned maybe years into our friendship, but actually all of her Indian friends, not that I'm not an Indian friend, but I was one Indian friend in a group of predominantly non-Indian friends. So we all called her Radhika. Even to this day, I call her Radhika. It would be very weird if I called her up and said, "Hey, Radhika, how are you doing?" Ooh. Because I just know her as that. But I think it's really, really sad that so many, not even South Asian people, so many people with names not from this country have had to put up with people not bothering or not making the effort to pronounce someone's names correctly, that they have had to think, "Do you know what? Doesn't really matter. Just call me what you want." I think that's really, really sad.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's your identity, man. That is so important, your identity. And that's why I recently did a post on my Instagram, and it upset me for so long. It still does hurt me a little bit. "You don't look Indian. Are you actually Indian?" "No, but you're not that Indian." "Well, I'm not that Indian because I've got a British accent and because I'm fair skinned. Right. My family are from North India, which is generally fairer skin." Do not question people's identity. And it's because it's just so important to that person. I think it's sad when people have to, change the way that their name is pronounced, which is so core to who they are, in order to make the other person feel less guilty about pronouncing their name incorrectly. And so that then extends to when we're chanting mantra. I also think on a separate note, sorry, just really quickly, that when people learn how to pronounce correctly, and most importantly, when people understand the meaning, they're like, oh, because they have a deeper connection with what does this mantra actually mean?
Yeah.
Rather than just chanting blindly, they're going to get more out of that practice. So I think with chanting mantra, whether you understand it or not, you still get the benefits because it's healing, but when you understand it, it takes you to a deeper level of consciousness.
It does,
and that's what's important, I think, in progressing through the practice.
Thank you. I think you've clarified that really, really well.
But you have to sit with it yourself and make your own opinion. Like, this is just what I think. I think it's good that we are having this conversation.
Yeah. No, I think I pretty much agree with what you're saying. I think it even shows a sign of love. No, like, you meant to chant the bhav, or the mood in which you chant these mantras, is with bhakti, with love. And so if you really love someone, you're going to say the name properly, you know, especially when it comes to the name of divinity, the name of God, the name of... Yeah, so I think it's important. And also, you know what? I was thinking about this. I generally ask people how they like to pronounce their names. And it's because people have got mine wrong so often. And so it means that I naturally go, "So, by the way, is it Angie? Is it Tiwari? Is it Tiwari?" Like, you know, it's important for me because I've been on the receiving end. So it also makes you care about others, actually. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. This has been a super, super good combo. And I've been really relaxed around you. Thank you.
Oh, good. I feel chilled as well.
Yeah. So chilled out. Can we do some quick fire questions?
Yeah.
You up for it?
Yeah, let's do it.
I warn you. Okay. Some people get completely flummoxed by these.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but it's good fun.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do it. I'm ready.
Okay. Let me find them. Bear with me. They're somewhere here. Here we go. Question number one. What's something you're curious about right now?
Vedic meditation.
Really?
Want to know more.
I want to know
this
more.
This isn't a quick fire anymore.
It's
never on your face.
A quick fire. Everyone that listens to this podcast is like, he never does quick fire questions. I don't care. Tell me more.
I guess back to what I was saying earlier about being a seeker. So the word sadhaka.
Yeah.
So really like diving into being a seeker. I have always chanted mantra. I grew up with my grandma teaching me, my mom, my dad. Like, I've always...
Do you have any favorites?
I love Om Jajagadishare. Okay. It's one of the first I taught my boy. My husband chants mantra with me.
Really?
He knew how to chant the Gayatri Mantra very early on.
Far out.
He's great. Hanuman Chalisa, we grew up on. That's,
first thing I learned.
Yeah, my sister and I thought that was like... We almost kind of wrapped it. We just thought it was so cool and loved it. But then there's a difference between chanting out loud and chanting internally and in saying it in your heart. And I think I said to Stu when we spoke the other day that my practice is extremely personal to me. Like, I share very openly on the internet and on retreats. That's different. That's kind of more an education piece and sharing little snippets. My own practice is different. I'm not going to film that and put it on social. That's different. And I am, let's just say, I'm really, really enjoying going deep into seeking, and specifically just had a few moments with Vedic meditation and using mantra, which I haven't really experienced before. And I'm finding it really good for me and really, I'm going deeper, which is amazing. I love that.
A principle that I read recently in the Srimad Bhagavatam talks about how we should hold our practices really sacredly secret.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like this, that when you love someone really intimately and deeply, then some things you share, like you share some of the the external things, some of the things that maybe are commonly experienced. But then if you have a really profound experience, then it cheapens it when you go and just share it really publicly.
Yeah.
And so if someone asks me, have you seen God, or what's your feeling when you're chanting this particular chant, or, I'll share some things. But there's some things that I think if you're just prostituting them out just for the sake of name and fame, or for the sake of getting validation from others because you're experiencing deep, profound spirituality, quote unquote, it could be surface level. But for me, it's deep.
Yes.
To prostitute that out cheaply, I think it's really important that spirituality doesn't become a culture of showing off our spirituality and showing off our connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I super value keeping things
private. I don't want an opinion on a kind of breakthrough moment where I visualize something. I don't need your like.
Right.
I don't want your opinion on it. I know what happened. Right. I know, because I know deep in my soul what happened and what took place.
Yeah.
I don't need to share it with anyone. Yeah. I know that I felt the tears that came up. I don't need the validation from anyone. So, but yeah, I would say that at the moment, absolutely, hugely.
Far out. What's something you're personally working through at the moment?
Finding comfort and acceptance in a very transformative time. That's so vague. I just realized.
I'm into it. We'll keep it.
Let's leave it at that.
It was interesting because we were talking about not sharing too personally, and then the next one was personally working through. So I was like,
yeah,
I was like, oh, she answers it. She answers it. She doesn't. She doesn't. So being true to that, we'll move on. Number three. In short, what legacy would you like to leave behind in this world?
Well, that's a deep question.
Yeah, it's not a quick fire question.
Yeah, that you shouldn't name this quick fire.
We need to come up with a new name.
Long
for these.
Fire.
Yeah. Should we do some long fire questions?
Legacy. I want people to feel accepted. And I realize I'm making this long fire now. I'm just going for it. But yeah. I realize through the retreats or spaces where you bring people together that we're all really quite similar. And we all just want to be accepted. And we seek the validation to make us feel accepted. And it's fine to seek validation. We're humans. That's just human truth. But you really feel that. And I try and be, especially my close friends who know me, if I back you and you're my close friend, I back you. I'm your hype gal. I am your number one fan. I will support everything that you do. And I want people to feel that. I back you, I accept you.
Wow.
And people to feel accepted. And also people to walk away from the practices and the experiences that I bring, retreats, events, or sharing the practice of yoga from my culture, from the ancestors. I want that to make people feel accepted as well.
Amazing. Something that came to mind. Radhanath Swami shares this quote. He says that the deepest need for every human being is to love and to be loved. And I think that need is comes out in so many different ways, acceptance and, so many different... But the deepest inner core is that we want to be loved and we want to express love to others. But because of different impressions of how love is received, we sometimes can close ourselves off to that. So, yeah, I know that he probably took the quote from someone else. I think it was Mother Teresa, so I don't know. Maybe someone can check it and let me know. But I'm pretty sure it was from, he's definitely said it. So anyway, just prompted what you were speaking. Number four, something you used to deeply value but don't value as much anymore.
People's opinions.
Straight up. And number five, this is the last one. If you could create one law that everyone in the world had to follow, what would it be?
Speak to people. I feel like there's a lot of fear to get out of your close group knit of friends and to stay in your echo chamber. And when you don't feel so fearful to speak to a stranger or go to a party where you don't necessarily know everyone and have a conversation with someone that you don't know, because then you start to realize we are all a lot more similar and you kind of regain your faith in humanity. And exactly what you were just saying about the love and be loved, like that, we need to get out of our echo chamber every now and then and put ourselves in situations where we don't necessarily feel comfortable and not be afraid to speak to someone and build connection.
This has been an epic episode. No? I'm looking at my team around.
Please nod. Please nod.
They're nodding. They're validating.
Give me the validation.
Thank you so much, Angie. This has been an epic episode. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for bringing your truth and kindly doing it. You know, doing it in a way that it's accessible and it's sweetly presented. And I really warmed to you. I think that you're an awesome person. And I can't wait to connect outside of this podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, go and check out Angie. Go and check out all the amazing things she's doing. Go on a retreat with her. Go and find out all the stuff she's doing with Unearthed. And if you found that there was anything in this conversation that helped you, that has given you hope, strength, etc., then feel the permission to re-listen to this episode. Yes, I know nowadays everything is a one-time fling, but feel free to go back, rewind, re-listen to it, maybe listen to it in a more relaxing state. Maybe if you're doing something really active right now, feel permission to re-listen to it. Tag us on Instagram, share this far and wide, make this conversation go viral, because I think that honest conversations on wellness and spirituality are very much warranted and so much desired and so much needed in the world. And so I can't do it on my own. I need your help. So please do that for us. And look forward to seeing you on the next episode of For Soul's Sake. Thank you very much. Namaste. For Soul's Sake.